Concert Program 3 prefaces a beloved work by one of Western music's most hallowed masters, the string sextet in B-flat by Johannes Brahms, with music by two of Central Europe's most distinct compositional voices. The program begins with Leos Janáček's haunting violin sonata, followed by the sonata for solo cello by Georges Ligeti. In the years since his death in 1928, the Czech composer Leos Janáček has increasingly become regarded as one of the 20th century's most original composers. His 9 operas represent his crowning achievement, and Janáček considered these to be his most important work. But he also produced a fair amount of chamber and orchestral music, and the dramatic instinct and rhetorical expressivity that infuse his operatic output are key elements of his style, and likewise inform his instrumental works. Janáček was especially preoccupied with the Czech language, and in his chamber and orchestral music, attempted to capture the cadence and inflection of Czech in his melodic writing. The result is a brand of expressive immediacy entirely unique to Janáček. Janáček's earliest forays into chamber music composition included 2 violin sonatas composed in 1880, now lost. He returned to the genre 34 years later. His sole extant violin sonata is one of a spate of chamber works created in the composer's maturity, including Pohádka, Mladý, and his 2 string quartets, the Kreutzer Sonata and Intimate Letters.
The violin sonata reflects the tortured zeitgeist of the outset of the First World War. In the 1914 sonata for violin and piano, Janáček later reflected, quote, "I could just about hear the sound of steel clashing in my troubled head," end quote. Such disquiet indeed marks the striking gesture that begins the work. A sforzando cry by the violin alone launches an anxious theme surrounded by clangorous tremolandi in the piano. Restless transfiguration of this theme unifies a sequence of otherwise fragmented passages, as the music's character shifts abruptly from nervous tension to hopeful lyricism and back. The second movement, which Janáček designates ballada, feels similarly unsettled. While at times seeming a gentle lullaby, this music too is marked by sudden changes in humor, rhythmic agita, and a general unpredictability, ultimately giving the listener no rest. ¶¶ The pithy Allegretto Third Movement is at once demonically, dance-like, and frighteningly terse. Cascading 30-second note gestures swirl about the stomping theme, punctuated by emphatic silences. Jarring pauses likewise accentuate the final movement, as angry exclamations in the violin interrupt the piano's melancholy lyricism. This uncomfortable dialogue continues throughout the finale. And the sonata concludes pianissimo, less resolved than resigned.
Unquestionably one of the most singular compositional voices of the 20th century, the Hungarian composer George Ligeti was regarded by many, by the end of his life, as Western music's greatest living composer. Ligeti's music reflects his assimilation of a wide spectrum of cultural elements. Artistically descendant from Bartok, Ligeti later encountered the avant-garde community emergent at Darmstadt. In the early 1980s, he extended his sonic palette further, immersing himself in non-European musical cultures. His interest in Caribbean, African, and East Asian music complemented the influence of his own Hungarian heritage. But ultimately, regardless of his aesthetic sources, Ligeti was always guided by his personal sound idea. His music reveals a free-spirited imagination and infinite curiosity given to sonic exploration and adventure. The Sonata for Solo Cello illustrates a distinctive feature of Ligeti's compositional technique: his deep understanding of an instrument's character and expressive capabilities. The sonata comprises two movements. The first, titled Dialogo, is indeed a poignant dialogue between two contrasting musical ideas, each one singularly characteristic of the cello. The first, a pair of strummed chords, one sliding into the next. The second, a deeply felt melody, exploiting the cello's vocal expressivity. Ligeti composed the Dialogo in 1948, near the end of his studies at the Budapest Academy of Music. Ligeti also admitted that the movement's tenderness owed to his secret amorous feelings for a young cellist and classmate of his at the Academy of Music, who, never aware of Ligeti's feelings, politely thanked him for the gift of the dialogo and never played it.
There is a conversation between two different registers of the cello.
Dmitri Atapin.
Sometimes the cello sounds with a melody very low, and sometimes it goes very high. At times, it actually blends the two voices together with fairly intricate double stops, where two melodies are coming together in a kind of a imitation and canon. Those phrases are interspersed by these pizzicato chords that are marked with a little bit of sliding, a little bit of glissando. And I find these chords actually fascinating because I'm thinking of a kind of a string-plucked instrument, maybe a sort of cymbalum, which is a traditional Hungarian instrument, being tuned up as the player is trying it, adjusting some notes, and then singing along with it.
Several years later, in 1953, Ligeti met the cellist Vera Denes, who asked him for a cello composition. The dialogo having never been performed, Ligeti added a virtuosic capriccio to it as a second movement. In the composer's words, quote, "Because the second movement had the ambition to become a sonata movement, I wrote it in sonata form. It is a virtuoso piece in my later style that is closer to Bartok. I was 30 years old when I wrote it. I loved virtuosity and took the playing to the edge of virtuosity, much like Paganini." End quote.
Ligeti himself spoke of it as a kind of a student work that is not representative of his later style. Well, obviously that is the case, but it is a fabulous piece, and we cellists are very lucky that he turned to our instrument to write it.
Scholars widely recognize the end of the 1850s and early 1860s as Brahms's first maturity. It was in this period of his career that the composer was able to fully assimilate the influence of such predecessors as Bach, Beethoven, and Schubert into his own distinct compositional voice. The numerous outstanding chamber works that mark this period include the work that closes Concert Program 3, the Sextet in B-flat Major, Opus 18.
Brahms famously delayed composing his first symphony until his mid-40s, citing the forbidding sound of Beethoven's footsteps behind him. Likewise, Brahms did not publish his first string quartet until 1873. During the period of his first maturity, as Brahms biographer Jan Swafford writes, quote, "String sextet was a characteristic choice of medium, partly because it sidestepped his apprehensions. In the 1860s, Brahms concentrated on fresher, acoustically richer, more nearly orchestral chamber mediums that happened to be less thunderous with the tramp of giants." End quote. Indeed, the B-flat sextet rings with a grand sonority, affirming what Robert Schumann heard in the young Brahms' chamber writing as veiled symphonies.
This piece is just symphonic in scale. I think that's the best word I can use to describe it.
violinist James Thompson.
And it's clear right from the beginning, I think, that Brahms really takes advantage of having all six instruments to work with. And there aren't any, I think, textures in this piece that you could really mistake for a string quartet if you were to just kind of turn on the radio in the middle of the work or something like that. I mean, it really feels like a meaty piece. So we've got this gorgeous first movement, classic Brahms writing, these long sweeping melodies, a lot of music that's sort of written over the bar line.
In a letter to Clara Schumann written around this time, Brahms declared, quote, "Passions are not natural to mankind. They are always exceptions or excrescences. The ideal, genuine man is calm in joy and calm in pain and sorrow." End quote. Perhaps drawing from the idyllic setting of Detmold, the quiet forest town where Brahms was working when he began the sextet, a sense of stillness permeates the music. Even when Brahms writes a waltz into the first movement, it is less in the spirit of salon gaiety than pastoral serenity. The second movement is a set of variations on the same traditional melody, La Folia, on which Vivaldi based his Trio Sonata No. 12 in D minor, Opus 1. Brahms sets the first elegiac statement of the theme in the viola.
And it's a theme in variations, a form that Brahms, I think, was particularly well known for throughout his compositional career. Almost feels like a funeral march. You're just sort of trudging forward. Schoenberg always admired Brahms' ability to continually vary the material that he used in his compositions. So this is definitely an example of that technique that he did so well. Third movement is really fun. It's a sort of bouncy rustic scherzo, or minuet and trio rather. And it's got all of these sort of folksy elements that composers like Schubert would like to incorporate into their music to give it a little bit of a slightly less urban flair. Thank you. There's actually echoes, I believe, of Schubert both in this movement and in the final one. Brahms is so tuneful, and the way that he slips between keys and harmonies in such a suave and interesting way, I think, in this piece, certainly reminds me of Schubert. The last movement is just another beautiful movement. Brahms, he himself, I believe, admitted at times that he struggled with last movements of his pieces, which is kind of a unique problem to have. And I always felt like it's not that the last movements were, you know, bad in any way. I think that the last movements are just not typically what one would expect to have in the last movement. It's not the sort of flair and, you know, brass stuff at the end of symphonies and things like you might find at the end of a great Beethoven symphony or something like that. But sometimes these movements are somewhat understated, but both in terms of the emotion and in terms of sort of pulling back material from previous movements, I think it really ties the whole piece together. It's not a piece that's about blaring trumpets and victory flags at the end, but there's something I think you can really just sort of sit back in your chair and have it sort of wash over you at the ends of the piece. Joachim even, I think, complained about he wished that there was a little more fire and brimstone. But I actually find the ending really beautiful and satisfying.
Audio Notes is authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Leoš Janáček's Violin Sonata, performed by Adam Barnett Hart and Juho Pohonjan, appears courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Janáček's Pohádka, performed by Keith Robinson and Hayan Park. George Ligeti's Bagatelles for a Wind Quintet, performed by Carol Winsens, William Bennett, Anthony McGill, Dennis Godburn, and William Vermeulen. And Sonata for Solo Cello, performed by Narek Haknazarian. Antonio Vivaldi's Trio Sonata No. 12, La Folia, performed by Soo-Yun Kim, Yehonatan Barak, Eric Kim, and Alessio Bax. And Johannes Brahms's Sextet in B-flat Major, Opus 18, performed by Yehonatan Barak, Arno Sussman, Yura Lee, Paul Neubauer, Eric Kim, and Lawrence Lesser, and Franz Liszt's arrangement of Schubert's Die Forelle, performed by Gilles Van Sottel, are available on Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.